Hey everybody, thank you so much for coming out tonight. I know it's a busy time, a crazy time, and I want to do two things tonight. I want to first give you guys an opportunity to have a dialogue and a safe space to feel just Jewish on campus. I think that's already just Aleph, like letter A. Number two, I want to talk a little bit to you about how you actually have a voice, how you have power, and how unity is the very message through which we could do that, especially in the context of a war. So first, let's just be very honest right now. There is an insane amount of protests on the other side going on this campus and across the entire country. We're at war. Our people are at war. A war that has not hit our country, our people, even this country to its core in ages, years. So I want to open it up literally right now before I even dive into anything, just to ask people who are brave enough to volunteer, how do you feel about what's happening right now? How do you feel about the war? Where are you holding, so to speak, in your emotional relationship with everything? Who is brave enough to get that open and on the table?
I mean, sometimes I feel powerless because I know that I know a lot about Israel and just a lot of facts on the ground, but sometimes when I'm taking a political science class, my professor will just throw something out that's like pretty blatantly anti-Semitic, and it takes a second for me to process it, and we already moved past it. So I feel like I should say something right away, but it's not always at the tip of my tongue.
Amazing. And it's not only that it's a student, it's the professor, or it's the student?
Professor.
So even more so. So not only that, you have the question of, should I even be saying this in the first place, even if I could interact properly and effectively? Very nice. Who else? Safe space. Awesome. So it seems what I'm hearing is you have this professor who is like understanding, empathetic, and gets it, but there's this worry of like as you walk around campus, like, do I have to look over my shoulder? What's going to be?
Yeah, I think that's the fear on campus is another aspect. I was walking literally this morning and I saw like people like tearing down the like kidnapping, like Israeli kidnapping signs, like putting up the Palestinian like martyr signs with like really horrifying pictures of kids. And I was just like shocked. Like, they were doing that right outside of the lot. And I just felt really scared. Like, I was literally shaking. And when I passed by them, like, I covered up. Like, I'm wearing a shirt that says Rotora. I literally put my hand like this because I was afraid that, I don't know, something would happen.
Thank you for sharing.
I don't want to live with fear on campus.
You got it.
It's ridiculous. No one deserves to.
100%. That's the first piece of tonight. That is the first piece of tonight. You should not have to live in fear at all, anywhere you go, on campus, off campus, wherever you are. You should be proud to be a Jew. You shouldn't have to cover up anything. When I got here, I wore this on full display, almost unzipped this, black and white, whatever's going to be is going to be. But you have to get to a place where you're comfortable with that. And so I'm hoping to be able to give you some understanding of how you can do that. Okay.
So it made me feel like
kind of
weirded out, but at the same time, it was like, what
are
you paying attention to us for, you know?
100%. So are these isolated incidents, or are these the general tenor of Rutgers University? What do you guys think? I don't know, I'm asking. Nice. I was hoping to hear that answer also. I want a diverse, very good. So it sounds like it's present. It is there. Hopefully it's not as palpably, you know, out in the open. But when it is, it's frightening. And it's almost making you feel a little powerless, right? That was the word powerless?
100%.
Okay. So tonight I want to talk to you exactly about how you're not powerless in any way whatsoever. But to do that, I'm going to use Jewish sources to open it up a little bit. And if anything I say you don't understand, say, Bob, I have a question. And jump in and ask me what I'm saying. I'll try to define everything I say, and we'll go that way. First and foremost, it's important to know in the world, there are two worlds, not just one. We have a physical world and a spiritual world. The physical world is obvious. It's this table. It's a human being. It's the floor. It's everything that you can see, touch, taste, feel, and everything else. Then there's a spiritual world. And those of you who believe in God will resonate with this greatly. Those of you who don't may or may not. But ultimately, we can all appreciate the Jewish outlook on what that spiritual world is. The spiritual world is everything else going on in and around in the spiritual realms that we don't see. In a certain sense, like germs, my rabbi, Rabbi Gershenfeld, would say, we can't see, touch, or taste a germ, unless you use a microscope, a very powerful one, depending on the germ, to see it. But even then, you can't really see it as it is a germ. So too with spirituality. Spiritual things are real. Our prayers matter. The words that we utter at a prayer vigil just before this event right now matter. We have the capacity to change the world with our words, with our speech, with everything that we do. And it's not just lip service. It's real. And so the way that we can combat our powerlessness is actually seeing that maybe I am physically powerless in a certain sense. I have a friend. He wanted to go fight in the war. He literally heard about it right after Simchas Torah. And he told his wife, I'm going to Eretz Israel. I'm going to Israel. I'm going to grab a gun. I'm going to go fight. I'm going to fight. And his wife just looks at him. It's like, you have two kids. You have me. You work as a, I don't want to say, you people may know. You work. Like, what are you doing? And so immediately after that, because obviously he had this whole mindset, right? He had his, like, you know, battle gear on in his mind. He's like ready to rock, going there with his music, and he's going to fight. And his wife is like bringing him back down to reality, which is like, wait a second. You're going to go drive the kids to school tomorrow. It's like, oh. And then immediately he felt powerless. Because if you're only fighting physically, you will feel powerless. But if you fight spiritually, which is what we're doing right now in this room as we're learning Torah, what we did when we go to a vigil, when we do whatever it is that we're doing in our own capacity, that's fighting the spiritual war. How do I know that? What's my source? I didn't make it up. It comes from the Torah. It's in the Torah portion that we're going to read very soon, called Vayishlach. An epic battle between Jacob and Esau. Yaakov and Esau is going to happen. In Vayishlach. And what happens? You have a physical altercation where you actually have Yaakov Avinu, Jacob our father, Yaakov Avinu going to pray and he's going to fight and do battle with Esau. And Esau is coming with 400 men and wants to attack him physically. And spiritually, we have the angel. This is the whole wrestling match for those who are familiar. There's the wrestling match, whatever that means spiritually. There's a dust up, literally, of spiritual dust that somehow ascends all the way up to the heavens. And yet that deep battle that is hard for us to grapple with and understand is real and it's live. That's the source for how we know that there's two worlds. And that this battle that we're in right now has two sides to it. So I think it's very vital to appreciate where we're coming from, what's going on with all of that, and how we ourselves can fight on the spiritual front. So I want to open it up again. I like discussion, and I know I don't like long speeches either. And I think discussion is far more formal. How can we fight the spiritual war? What can we do? How can we not be powerless? High hands. If you got an answer, just, yeah. Great. We could do mitzvah, commandments. What, give an example. Keeping Shabbos, beautiful. Very nice. I like that. What about us who aren't really there yet? Let's say I don't want to keep mitzvahs right now. What about that? I'm not there yet, but I know that I could still fight the spiritual war. Mitzvahs are awesome, but what if I don't want to... Yeah.
So you could just do good things in general, just positive things, like talking to friends and family over there while supporting them.
Awesome. I love that. I think that's tremendous, because that's, in a certain sense, a way of creating what I want to talk about tonight. Achdus, or unity. It's also doing a good deed, which in itself is a mitzvah. Beautiful. Yeah.
Donating.
Great. Tzedakah. Donating. Donating to a million causes. That's the beauty of Klal Yisrael, the Jewish nation coming together. I'm going to use that phrase a few times. Klal Yisrael. That means the Jewish people. All of us together. That's the beauty of Klal Yisrael. This thing happened, and immediately, like, you can't go online without seeing 80,000 different organizations that are, like, ready to do stuff. I saw on WhatsApp today a lady who lost somebody very close to her is just knitting. She's just sitting and knitting and involved in things that are going to do great, good things for the troops. Or other people who are donating tons of money for armor, helmets, materials. And it's making a difference. And although that is physical, you're taking it and making it spiritual. Beautiful. So there's a big rabbi in Israel. His name is Rabbi Asher Weiss. I love him. Rabbi Asher Weiss is one of the most brilliant, leading geniuses of our generation. And he says that one of the best ways, and again, big caveat, I'm not here to tell you what you have to do. And I'm not here to tell you that this is the only path to take. I'm here to submit to you that I think this is a good approach. And that's about it. It's a good approach. I don't know why this happened. And anyone who says that they do is probably either a prophet and amazing or lying. That said, Rav Asher Weiss tells us that unity is going to be the thing that we can use to fight the spiritual battle right here at Rutgers University. And we're doing it right now. Look around the room and see how many people are in this room tonight, sitting and coming out to this at a horrible time, who were at a rally just a little bit ago, or wherever they may be, coming together. It's funny, when I was in rooms like this, I used to listen to punk rock music. And one of the bands that I just listened to doesn't exist anymore as of this year. And they sang a song called One People, One Struggle. And in the beginning of it, Anti-Flag, at the beginning of the song, every person in that band would go, "The people united will never be defeated." And they would just shout that, which is the protest chant. The people united will never be defeated. And if you think about it, in a secular context, in a non-religious context, I can't prove that to you. I don't know. But if we add on a word, the Jewish people united will never be defeated. I can give you Torah sources for that. I got three right now. First, Purim. Who knows the holiday of Purim? Raise your hand if you're familiar with the holiday of Purim. The Purim is beautiful. I don't have to explain it. Nice. During Purim, we had Esther and Mordechai trying to save us from spiritual annihilation. We were literally going to be wiped out. Sound familiar? We were completely surrounded by an evil plot by a man named Haman, who wanted to destroy us. What did Esther say? She said, "Vitzumo alai, fast on my account, but also gather all the Jews. Gather them together." And it's through that unity that we survived. Second story, second proof. Who's familiar with the Ten Commandments? Who's familiar with how we got them? Moses goes up on the mountain. Moshe Rabbeinu goes up on the mountain. Har Sinai. What was the prerequisite for that? Do we just get the Torah because we're special? Maybe, maybe not. Do we just get the Torah? Is there preparation that we have to do? Yeah, a lot of it. Some of the preparation that went into that, Rashi talks about. Rashi's a famous medieval commentary on the Torah. He tells us that we had to be Ke'ish Echad B'lev Echad. We had to have Ke'ish Echad, like one person, one man, B'lev Echad, with one heart. What's that mean? We were not able to receive the Torah until we were united. Why? Because when the Jewish people aren't united, we can be defeated. We don't merit the Torah. We don't necessarily merit divine protection. Rav Asher Weiss tells us that possibly, one of the reasons for us being vulnerable, and even Hamas admits this, for the reason why they chose now to attack us, is that we were politically divided. We were spiritually divided. We were not necessarily all on the same page, and therefore, we're weaker. Third proof. This comes from the Talmud Yerushalmi, Peah 1:1, Jerusalem Talmud. And it says that and you might have heard this before, it's been passed around by a lot of different sources. It's a beautiful idea. In the generation of Ahav, they were idol worshippers. The Jewish people were idol worshippers. They didn't keep any of the mitzvahs. They didn't keep any of the Torah. But yet, they didn't say lashon hara, evil speech, gossip, talking negatively about other people. They didn't do any of that. But they didn't necessarily learn the Torah the way they should have, and they didn't keep the mitzvahs the whole way, but they merited divine protection, and they won their battles. In the generation of Sheol, where they did learn Torah, and they did do mitzvahs, and they were very, as we say in the classics, stark, they didn't merit divine protection, and they lost their wars. Why? Because they said lashon hara. They were not unified, and they attacked other people through their speech on their level, right? On their exalted, lofty level of whoever they were, that's what they meant. That's what the Gemara says. So we have three proofs now, Torah textual sources, Hobbit and Boria, but we got three sources that tell us that unity is the thing that keeps us together, but also has us merit protection. So, what can we do to be more united? Discussion question. What can we do to be more united on campus, off campus, other places? Because if it's going to allow us to be to have this divine protection, it's pretty significant, I would think. It's the main weapon we have that we might not even think about having in our arsenal when we're trying to fight spiritually this war. Some of us didn't even know that we were on the front lines, by the way, in this room. Everyone in this room is. Whether you know it or not, you're on the front lines in the spiritual battle. You're Jewish. You were selected. You were chosen to be. So how are we going to unite? What can we do?
I think we already are.
Nice.
I think we already are.
Explain that a little bit more.
We all have this, it's called combined trauma. You know, combined fear for our homeland. So that just, I guess, bonds everyone.
100%. You hear what he's saying? What's your name?
Yehuda.
Yehuda's saying we're already united. In a certain sense. Maybe we don't have the sensitivity to pick up on it, but we are all hurting. We are all going through a trauma. And I don't care what you look like, if you're Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, nothing. It doesn't matter. We are all hurting. We are all Jewish. We're all here. Nice. What can we do to take that up a notch? How do we fire that up? How do we take that starting ground, which is beautiful, and essentially kindle that flame? What can we do to be more united? Yeah.
Communicate?
Flesh that out for me.
I guess speak with other Jews.
Nice. Very good. I think many of us are already doing that, right? We're here tonight. I think a lot of us will tend to hopefully spend time with Jewish individuals also on campus, off campus. But yeah, now's a better time than ever to, you know, kindle those relationships with Jews. What else we got? All right, so then I'll dive into my piece over here. I think it's very vital to understand, even just what unity is, and how to appreciate that unity isn't just one-dimensional. Unity has two dynamics. There's the positive aspects of unity, which we're all aware of. What can we do? We sort of hinted to it. We're already unified, things like that. But also, we can gather together and pray. We can gather together and write cards to the troops. We can gather together and donate. But what's the other side of unity that we don't always like to talk about? Disunity, the negative side. What breaks us apart? What fractures us apart? What separates us? What keeps us from being united and not defeated? Jealousy. I submit to you that jealousy is one of the biggest things that keeps us fractured and broken apart. And when you're jealous of somebody else, oh, I don't want to be with that guy at all. Look at him. Oh, look what she does. Ugh, I wish I had that. That is not uniting. So I want to open up your mind to a possibility. Even if you're not the jealous type, we all have that in us to some extent. I'll use a parable. Imagine for a second that you are building birdhouses. Your job is to build birdhouses. That's what you get paid the big bucks to do. You build birdhouses. And you know where the best wood is, the best nails, the hammers, the drills, everything you need. And your goal in life, as it's been told to you, is to build the best birdhouses ever. Now, you're doing that, doing well, happy. One day you see your buddy, who's a metal worker, with a blowtorch. There he is, with this blowtorch, with this flame, it's blue, soldering away with all of his, in all of his glory. And you're over there just looking and looking. Like, that's kind of cool. Maybe I should have that blowtorch. Day by day you go by and you see, I got these tools. They don't make fire, they don't do anything like that. You see him soldering away, thrilled and happy. Over time you say, you know what, I wish I had that blowtorch. You start not liking your friend anymore. You start wanting to have that blowtorch. Now, we know that this is absolutely fundamentally absurd. Nobody's going to be a birdhouse builder. Nobody's going to be a metalworker. But this is real, right? That if that birdhouse builder got that blowtorch, all of his work would be completely destroyed. His birdhouses would be burnt to a crisp. When we long after the traits, characteristics, strengths of others, we are denying our, I'm going to use that word, God-given purpose in this world. Every single person was put into this world with strengths, talents, abilities, a package, so to speak, that no one else has or will ever have in the history of mankind. How do I know that? The Torah says so, and I believe the Torah is true. It says that. And if you look around, you'll also see it. You'll see it. You have strengths and talents that no one else has. What are you going to do with them? You're going to sit back, kick back on the beach and just hopefully have a great life and make a whole lot of money? Or am I going to do something meaningful? Am I going to stand with the Jewish people? Am I going to use my strengths and talents to make positive change in the world? Or am I going to long after and yearn for those of others, a blowtorch that could actually toast and torch my own purpose in the world? I'm here to tell you that unity starts when we can drop the blowtorch, drop the desire to have that, and come together and say, wow, that's awesome that you have that blowtorch. I'm thrilled that I have these nails, this hammer, this drill. But that's awesome. I'm coming to bond together with you in solidarity and show you how amazing that is. No, I don't have that. But you know what? It's even better that I don't have that. I have my own God-given package of what I'm supposed to have, what I'm supposed to utilize, and how I can actualize my potential. That is the other side of unity. How you combat jealousy. How do you think, other than just having simcha, happiness, joy about our own strengths and talents, how else can we combat jealousy? What can we do? How do we combat jealousy? Nice. Very good. And sometimes you could do that by recognizing your internal greatness, like your strengths, your talents, abilities. But other times it might need something else, right? So how would you be able to raise your own self-esteem so that you really feel deeply good about yourself without having to worry about what other people think or what they have? That is a tough question. But it's one for all of us to think on and to reflect on and to appreciate and to resonate with. When we recognize that our self-esteem and self-worth is not a function of what other people think, that's when we can actually be ourselves. That's when we can have a self to even try to unite to another self with. Questions, comments, reactions, we're good so far? Yeah.
Would you say that jealousy could be honest to improve yourself?
Jealousy could
be honest to improve yourself.
Absolutely. And there's a phrase which basically says, I'll translate it from the Hebrew to the English, which is that jealousy among Torah scholars is something that can increase wisdom. And you can extrapolate that even further. You could say that being jealous in a positive sense, when used and channeled appropriately, like any character trait, like any midah, is something that you can use to hopefully help elevate you. But you have to do it in small doses, I would say. Meaning you have to know yourself very, very well before you want to harness something like that, yeah? But you could work on it to the point where you're happy with yourself and you say, wow, that guy's doing awesome. I should be doing things like that too. But it can't be, ugh, that guy's doing so great. You know what I mean? There's a difference. There's a difference there. What else? How can we combat jealousy and be able to come together and unite? quiet room, guys. I'm going to make you think. How do we combat jealousy? We had one answer, which was raising self-esteem. This, I suggested understanding and appreciating your talents that you have. Yeah. Nice. That's huge. Whether you're biased or whether you're just open and wanting to communicate with somebody and being real. Yeah? Awesome. I think all of that is huge. And then if you're real to yourself and to others about where you stand, that at least puts everything out there, all your cards are on the table. Nice. Yeah. Beautiful. The more that you refine your own self, the more that you don't have to worry about the self of others. I like that a lot. So now I want to take another dynamic, another approach to the negative aspects of unity and seeing what causes disunity. Speech, without a doubt. Speech is something that can cause a lot of disunity. I know many people who have been burned by friends and won't talk to them for years, decades. Don't want to show my age. Decades. And they don't want to actually have a communication with anybody. They don't have an open mind. Speech. Speech is the essence of everything. When you recognize that the power of your speech actually can change worlds, that's when you can unite with other people. There's a very famous phrase in Mishlei. Death and life are in the hands of the tongue. What's that mean? Death and life are in the hands of the tongue. We get this physically. A general can say an order, and then a bomb can go off. But even more so, the words that we say can either spiritually build people and build worlds or destroy those worlds. So I'm going to just say it's called a mashal, a parable, an example for something that's in the Torah as well. It happens to come from a medrash in Shokar Tov Tehillim. And it goes like this. There was a king, and he was very, very sick. And all of his advisors weren't able to diagnose any of what he had. They had no clue. He brings in all of his doctors to find out what's going on with me. What's the deal with me? What's happening? They couldn't tell him. The king sends out a proclamation. He says, anybody who can come and tell me what it is that I have and cure me, I'm going to make him wealthier, or she, wealthier beyond his or her wildest dreams and imagination. Whoa. No one answers the call. It's a true Torah source. No one answers the call. Why not? Well, because it's pretty hard to diagnose a king when every single doctor in the entire town has no clue what's flying. One small Jew comes and steps up to the plate and says, I know what you need, king. And the king says, oh yeah? What do I need? He says, you need a cure. You have a rare disease that's going to kill you. And if you don't have this addressed, you're going to die soon. You need the milk of a lioness. King looks at him like he's an idiot. What? I need the milk of a lioness? Yeah. You need the milk of a lioness. And I know how to get it. And I'm going to do just that. This king says, okay, if this Jew dies, I don't care. I'm sick anyway. Go ahead, go find the cure. Go try to find the cure. Go try to find the milk of a lioness for me. So what's this very intelligent dude do? Well, he knows that lions eat sheep. And he goes, he knows a thing or two about, you know, animal herding and husbandry, apparently. He takes a sheep, brings it to the place where he knows that a lioness is, and carefully, very carefully, shoves the sheep in the direction of where that cave is, and he hightails it, and he leaves. He does this day by day by day by day by day, getting a little bit closer every single time with a new sheep that he has from his herd. And each time, the lioness gets a little bit less afraid. Think about throwing like meat to a very, very like wild dog, but doing it all the time until the point where that dog knows exactly who you are. That's exactly what this man did. Until on the last day, that man was able to take that sheep, literally walk right up to the lioness who knew him right now, and milk the lioness right then and there. He was pumped and excited. He was thrilled he got the milk, the exact thing that he needed. And he goes right back to the king. In the process, he stays the night somewhere and he has a dream. And in this dream, as dreams go, all of his body parts were battling with one another. The eyes were saying, look at me, I'm great. I saw the whole thing. I knew exactly what to do. I'm the man, I'm the king. The feet said, what are you talking about? I got us there. Without me, you wouldn't even have made it where you are. The hands piped in. They said, what are you talking about? Without us, you wouldn't have been able to shove the sheep in the direction of the cave to do anything. And it went back and forth with all the body parts. The heart said, what are you talking about? Without me, there'd be no blood to pump. There'd be absolutely nothing going on whatsoever. You wouldn't have been able to be around. And then the mouth says something. The tongue speaks up. And the tongue says, you're all wrong. It was me. And I'm going to prove it to you tomorrow. I'm going to prove it to you tomorrow. The man wakes up from the dream, thinks that's a weird dream. And he goes right to the king. Goes into the king. And as he's there, he's ready. The king says, yeah, it's been a little while. Like, did you have something for me? Like, what's going on? He says, yeah, I have the milk of a dog. And every one of those body parts from that dream was like, what are you doing, tongue? What are you doing? He said, the tongue, in this parable, non-literal parable, what are you talking about? What are you doing? Like, are you kidding me? I'm the king. I'm the one who made this happen. I'm not going to say the right word until you acknowledge that. And so the king, in real time now, says, the milk of a what? Says, the milk of a dog. A dog, back then, was something that was very easy to milk. Anybody could really do it. So the king says, I could have done that myself. Any one of my people or my guards or any of my, you know, maidservants or slaves could have done that. What did you? Kill him. Kill the man, string him up, I want him dead. So now the man is like really terrified. And now all the body parts are like, listen, you have to absolutely now say the right thing. No, tongue says, I'm not going to say it until you admit that it's everything comes down to me. So they say, fine, we'll admit that everything comes down to you. The tongue is where it's at. He does, they do. And he says, oh, king, I want to let you know something. It was as easy for me to milk this lioness as it would have been for any one of your people to milk a dog. They take him out of the gallows. They don't kill him. They give him riches, and he is rewarded handsomely. What's the whole parable about? Death and life are in the hands of the tongue. We learn this about the power of speech and how we can actually impact people through our words, by building worlds, and by utilizing things like that. Death and life literally are in our hands and how we talk to people, whether it be something simple or something cosmically huge. Let's just have a small discussion, if it's okay, given the group. What is something that we could do to help other people through our speech and unite with them? Instead of doing something that can completely tear it apart, how do we give life through our words instead of tearing people down and giving them death in whatever capacity? How do we use our speech properly? Nice. I like that a lot. The power of positivity and just helping people along their way. Beautiful. Beautiful. And thank you for participating. Who else? What else we got? Yeah.
Show them
respect. Respect. Beautiful. How do I do that with my words?
Respect their person, respect what they have to say, and then follow what you have to say.
Nice. We could also extend that to body language. Body language is also very powerful. You see the person interacting in a certain way that resonates with you. That's also a form of speech. What else? What else do we got? Yeah. Expressions. Beautiful. Nice. And right here, I just want to close. We're at 40 minutes. One of the most critical things that we could do is recognize all the following that we spoke about. We have a lot of disparate things flying in the air, and I want to unite them. Number one, it's a crazy time right now. Two, There's a battle going on that we're involved in whether we want to be or not. There's a physical battle and a spiritual battle. Physical, we can't fight unless we actually enlist. But no, we are not powerless at all, because we can unite. And the Jewish people united will never be defeated. And just like during Purim, like we spoke about, and just like Ishachar B'Lev Echad at Mount Sinai, and just like the generation where, you know what, they were idol worshippers and they didn't do mitzvahs, but at the end of the day, what did they do? They spoke nicely about one another. They came together and they united. They were never going to be defeated, even though Shaul's generation was. We have the capacity to change worlds with our speech. We could take the opposite approach to unity and see, oh, you know what? Maybe I do have a little bit of jealousy. Maybe I want that blowtorch when we really shouldn't. You know what? Maybe death and life really are in the hands of the tongue, but I don't see it. By doing small, gradual things in this world, we can really shake it to its core and battle in our own way. No, this isn't as explosive and beautiful as like seeing the Iron Dome take away bullets and rockets. But when you go to a prayer vigil, when you are there saying Tehillim, when you are there uniting at Rutgers University right here from Maimonides, you are shaking the heavens whether you see it or not. Just like the germ that you can't necessarily identify, you are. So you should take, we call it chizik, strength from this, that you have power to do things that actually affect the world, to make people happier, to make the world a better place. And we should grow and be our best selves. Thank you for listening.